I was reminded this morning in the Q&A of just how much we try to be very careful up here with our expression of Buddhist philosophy and notions. It isn't that, at the same time as you can all see that we're very much a part of our lineages and tradition. but really to just, it felt important to offer that the reason is that we're so much more interested in helping give you all the tools to explore reality, your own body, your own mind, the truth on your own, versus having you like believe something that's part of a worldview or a particular set of beliefs. Because we just know that the faith that comes out of that process, which is a faith in the process of liberation, which is a faith in your own practice and the ability to understand the deepest truths, is just infinitely more important than kind of what you believe about certain things. We may even challenge views, and you might see in like the interviews, that you may offer something that feels in agreement with the sort of Buddhist notion. And it's, we may even challenge that not as a truth or an untruth of that belief, but as like, where is that coming from in terms of your direct experience? Where is that coming from in terms of what we've actually observed in the body and mind? Because we see and we know how much there is a tendency to bypass the process, to want to bypass the process of understanding through believing. And what we are always encouraging is a more and more dedication to the process of understanding. So belief or not, your own faith in the potential of your own happiness, of your freedom, is real and unshakable. You can see that tendency, to bypass the process, even to bypass wisdom in order to get what we think happiness is like a huge part of often how we can be what even motivates us to practice. That there's often a sense that we come to the cushion, we come on retreat, we dedicate ourselves to whatever degree because there's a part, we want to change ourselves, right? Maybe we have seen some unskillful behavior that we want to be able to change. Maybe we have some, emotional anguish that we want to get away from, to move beyond. And so those things are, there are wholesome roots to those, actually, in terms of the truth of suffering, right? And wanting to be alleviated from suffering. And yet it's very a slippery slope when we want to try to change ourselves, especially given how much we don't even know ourselves. Right? Like when we start to do this practice, we start to look in intensely on this experience of body and mind, we can often start to see just like how little we actually know what is the body and mind, right? What is mind and heart? What is this thing that's going on? We don't know it. We're often not even interested, right? It's okay, right? We really just, we want to be happy. We want to feel good, And it's like, of course, it's understandable. And yet, it's always worth asking, can you really be genuinely interested in something you're trying to manipulate? Can those two things actually go together? Can we say, well, I want to change this about myself, and actually be interested in that. Always a very, it can be an important question when you get into something where you see, you know, we see ourselves really kind of like trying to make something happen, trying to push, trying to get frustrated with ourselves about patterns that we just see over and over again, you know? And it can be hard. It can be really humbling to see these things that are very persistent, you know, in our inner worlds. But a lot of what happens out of this practice is just this willingness that you are all in at this point. You've all had experiences of it. You've all kind of, you know, danced with this tension at times of like, and you've all seen the difference. You know, you've all had a taste of it, of what it feels like to be genuinely interested and what it feels like to just want something to be different. It's so subtle most of the time, and it's worlds apart in terms of the relationship and in terms of what that creates. I was remembering actually today about how when I first started sitting, it happened because I was at a job that we sat for, at work every day for half an hour. Well, how cool is that? And I would notice, you know, right in the very beginning, I would notice that as I would sit there, there would be this like place on the top of my head that would just like muscles I didn't know existed. Like I just didn't even think you had muscles on the top of your head would start to relax, right? I didn't know they existed. I definitely didn't know they were tense. So I'd be there and be like, wow, that's really weird, you know, that's kind of cool. And I would take it as a sign of good or bad, right? Depending on if that one muscle or whatever like would relax, it would be like, oh, things are going good. And that's a sign of good practice and that it's going to have a good result or not, you know. And then, you know, over time, I would start to notice that, like, there's this tension kind of, like, around, you know, sort of ring of my head, you know. And then it was like, wow, my jaw is really tense, you know. And my nose, my eyes, and, you know, like, I would get into this thing. And finally, it was like, oh, okay, this is what this is about. This is, like, when I'm paying attention, things relax. And that is better than when they're tense. And and so we can see there is some relative truth to that and on some level, you know, that I won't get into, that, but it's not wisdom, right? Because what it starts to do is it's like this sort of internal little loop of like, oh, well, this is what, if this experience happens, then that means the practice is going well and that it's going to even feed back into my own enlightenment, right? That's sort of like, I'll just get more and more and more relaxed and that this is how it's all going to go. And it's just, you know, as the years have gone by, you know, it's just like it, that same experience is everywhere, you know, everywhere in the body. I can look and see the impact of the mind's contraction, right? The body, the way the body is burdened by the mind's response to reality, and vice versa. The way the mind is just, you know, it's relentlessly having to just have to deal with there being a body, you know? It's just like bodiness is just constantly asserting itself, you know? And it's this, so it's exhausting on both ends at times, you know? And yet, I have no aspiration that it's ever going to get fixed anymore, you know? I'm not saying I'm beyond wanting things to feel a certain way in my body. But it's like, you know, this elder monk that we've talked about sometimes in Burma, the Myatong Sayadaw, who's 98, you know, in the last few years as we've seen him, you know, I remember asking him, it's like, well, you know, when you can end dukkha in the mind, can you end body dukkha? And he was like, no, you know, definitely not. He's like, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And he laughs, you know. He's like, I can't see, I can't hear, you know, everything hurts, ha, ha, you know. It's like, what do you expect? You know, this is the nature to fail us at some point. No problem. Great, you know, no problem. And the mind can come to peace with that, you know, and it's like, oh, wow. And the way it comes to peace is through interest. It's right. It's through exploring the body, but also exploring the mind's relationship to the body, right? This like, oh, the wanting, the contraction around it, the not wanting, the this, the that, you know, the willingness to keep going through that, to keep seeing all the places where something else we wish was happening and all of that, that we begin to have what's called insight, right? Which is this sort of not intellectual, but this visceral understanding of the nature of things, right? Of bodies to do certain things, of minds to behave a certain way with certain causes and conditions are present. That's the process. And yet, you know, it can be painful and intense to see the degree to which we're really still living in a fantasy of ourselves right now and a fantasy of ourselves in the future. You know, our negative or positive fantasies of who we are, you know, of what needs to change, of who we might become. And really, like, the times where you can just really get, it's just thinking. It is not real, right? The thought about yourself is not you. The thought about your mother, your brother, your cousin, it is not them. It's just a thought. We live in a fabrication most of the time about reality. Very little time spent in actual reality of what is really happening right now in the body or in the mind. I kind of stay away from a lot of like the science of mindfulness stuff, but this is just science. This doesn't even have to do with mindfulness, so I'll offer some of these things. I was reading a cool thing about how they've done these studies on all these mummies from around the world, right? Egypt, South America, Europe, Asia, all kinds of places. And what they found is that the reason they did that is because, you know, some places only mummified their sort of elite class of people. Other places mummified everybody. Some people just got mummified because they got frozen somewhere. who knows what'll happen to all of us? But anyway, they found that like a huge percentage of them all had high cholesterol, and they're like thousands of years old. And they were like, we have this thing that we think it's this modern problem, and it is a modern problem, and yet, like, it's a human problem. Like, the body starts doing things in certain ways that are problematic as we get older, you know? And we have a hunger for certain kinds of food, and that's been there, you know? Since we were, like, monkeys or whatever, you know, I'm sure. And yet we are so identify with something like that. Say we have high cholesterol, right? It's like, oh, it's this guilt and sort of ashamed of it, and you have to take medicine. And it's like, geez, it's sort of like this part of our identity. You know, we wrap so much meaning around something like that. Wow, how much of that is extra, you know? They found the genetic, this one's nuts. Okay, you know how places will try to get people to stop smoking by raising the prices of cigarettes, right? But they have more and more taxes on the cigarettes. Well, they found that basically doesn't work, right? That there's some people for whom they actually will stop buying cigarettes because it costs too much, but most people will just keep doing it. And it's genetic. The people who stop doing it, they just have this certain gene that makes them have decisions about like their finances and health and like whatever that determines whether they're going to stop smoking because the price of cigarettes got higher. You know, that's that's like you just the degree to which you can't take what you're doing personally is unreal. You know, it's so deep. Like, that is the last one. I actually have more, but I'll just say this one. Cilantro. Whether you like cilantro or don't like cilantro is genetic, right? There's like, or it tastes, if it tastes like soap, you have a certain genetic thing. And that's like, you know, in this culture, and this, it's like a huge, it's like, oh, you know, you're like, well, I'm someone who likes cilantro, you know, or like, he's the guy who doesn't like cilantro, you know, whatever. It's madness. It's crazy. It's ridiculous. And yet our lives, who we are just formed out of these things that just have nothing to do with anything, you know? And, you know, and then we've all had, there's this, it's hard to get out from under that flood of fabrication. You know, as you all know, you know, I mean, you start to have this sort of, you can have a kind of contentious relationship with the mind, the thinking mind that develops, because it just feels like a problem, you know, where it's the thing keeping you from insight or what have you, right? When it, you know, instead it's just happening, it's just mind, it's part of this thing, but it's our belief in it because we're not seeing it clearly that ends up causing the troubles. You know, how to find our way underneath that to some kind of reality, something that we can point to and say it's real, it is not a fabrication, that has been experienced, is a big part of what we're doing here, you know, and it's often fleeting, right? I mean, that's how intense the fabrications are. I will say, I was watching this comedian who was talking about how he, now that he's sort of become successful and kind of famous, he rides first class a lot, and almost every time he flies, he'll see a young person in the military who gets on the plane, and he always has this sort of idea of like, oh, I should give him my seat, you know, thank him for his service, do, you know, be good and be generous and be kind, you know, and because I'm thankful, you know, or I respect something about that, you know, I respect the commitment someone else has made that they believe in about what they're doing. And he's like, I go through this whole thing, and I think about, you know, just like how good it would feel to do that, and, you know, just sitting in coach and knowing this guy was up there, and he's like, and I never do it. You know, and he's like, but I still feel good about myself for thinking about doing it, right? And you can just see how much of that we're like, we do here. It's like, oh, we're fantasizing about just like some great thing we're going to do, and just to be careful about that, you know, because whether it's great things or something bad we feel like we've done, you know, or something we're concerned we might do in the future, you know, or the hardness of ourselves, really getting, it's like that memory, that notion, it's just a thought. You're not really redoing it again. It's just a thought. Any connection we actually can have with our own goodness, with the impulse to be generous and kind, it actually is worth like feeling that, you know? It is worth letting that sink in a little bit, because that is where it starts, right? It actually starts with the impulse to do good, right? To be generous, to be kind. And there's a whole life of around that, of what our actions entail or not. So part of, you know, you could look at our efforts to anchor with the breath or whatever anchor we're using to stay with it over time, this process of, you know, concentration and mindfulness, you know, looking at it as something that is going to help get us kind of below, underneath this flood of fabricated experience that can sort of dominate and take over our lives, so that we can see things more clearly, And then a sort of a more authentic relationship to life comes out of that. Where the land, the Vipassana Hawaii land is in, on the Big Island of Hawaii, it's in an area called North Kohala. And it's famous for its winds, the Kamakani o Kohala, which are, it's often these just trade winds that are very, pretty regular and pretty consistent throughout the year. Certain times of the year where they're much more intense, but are kind of very persistent and regular most of the time. And it's so regular, in fact, that some of the folks who live there will tell stories about how when it stops, because sometimes it will happen, there's sort of other wind patterns will kind of come in and it'll be very quiet, that people will be sort of at home in their houses and they'll start hearing like these voices, they'll start hearing all these sounds, and they get totally freaked out, like someone's in the kitchen or someone's out here and someone's outside, and it's just their neighbors. It's just their neighbors that they never hear because there's just always wind going, right? And that the power of that sort of awakening sense of them, of being like, there's really all this stuff happening around me. And yet, because of these sort of constant winds, we just have no idea, you know, that we live in the sort of hum of that. And there's something very similar that can happen here on our practice, right? That we have times where we do drop below that, you know, where we have a moment of connection with the body or with the mind that feels unfabricated, right? That feels authentic in a different way. And you see how sometimes it can feel really strange, right? It can feel very foreign because we're that unused to actually seeing it, to having a relationship with it. And so then that's like a whole other process of like, is this how we're supposed to be feeling it? Is this really what the body feels like? You know, we can, you know, and then of course, you know, getting attached sometimes to that kind of experience versus, well, then the floodgates open at some point. Can that be okay? Can we be aware of that experience, right? Of hearing the wind, right? Are we actually aware that the winds are blowing all the time? Or do we just sort of tune out because it just feels like the natural flow of life? And so there's a way in which we invite a certain amount of intensity around the present moment, right? Of trying, you can see because of the intensity of the flood and the winds, right? You can see there are times where it feels like it takes so much energy to actually connect with the present moment, with what's happening right now. And you know you're pretty deep into a retreat right now, so it's a different quality of energy that you're often going to find at this point versus the first few days. You know, of like how much is just sort of like the kind of just digging in and just you know the getting some traction. You know, how much energy that takes versus where you know we sort of sometimes open to places where there's less energy needed to stay in the present moment. That there's more of a sense of resting in the present. You know, because we've cultivated that concentration, we've cultivated that mindfulness, that might be more accessible at times, you know. And then something happens, we get blown out of the water, and we start back from scratch, you know, trying to... You know, it's just like the... When you really... remind yourself or you really see the truth or hold your practice in the way of like the past does not exist. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it is not real. And the future is not real. There is just right this second. And it's moving quickly, right? It's like when you can really take that in at times, it's incredible, actually. And there can be moments of like, oh, yeah, well, It's not just intensity that gets us to this present moment. It's actually like a sort of surrender. It's like, thank God we only have one moment to pay attention to. You know? You don't have to worry about the past or the future or anything. It's like there's just this one thing to kind of tune into, you know? And then the wildness of all the six senses, which makes it harder. And thank goodness we don't have more than six senses to have to tune into and pay attention, right? It's like it's manageable. There's times where the present moment can feel totally outside of the realm of possibility, and then there's other moments where it's like, okay, it might be possible. It might be possible to just be with what's happening right now. Most of the time, what's overwhelming is notions about past, future, ideas about ourselves, but that what's actually happening in this moment is actually something we can handle. Most of the time, right? And then we go back to our process of backing off, bringing kindness, you know, the strategies that we have when actually the present moment is too intense for the what arisen qualities of mindfulness or patience or kindness are available at the moment. One helpful metaphor for me for this has been, you know, since moving to Hawaii, these are factors that are true in every landmass, some version of it, but has been, I think I've just met enough people who know about the natural world in this situation that I've had some offering around this to me that's been helpful, which is, you know, these islands were formed by these two very different kinds of forces. There's this incredibly fiery, powerful volcanic energy, right? Of just the most extreme heat and intensity and kind of elemental force coming out of the ocean floor that has created these land masses. And, you know, that you can go to, like, a volcano that's alive and see that process. And like, life is, it is alive. I mean, you realize that the land you are on is in the process of creation is very intense. And so there's that determined, intense energy, right? And then there's, like, how it got populated by plants and animals, which is a very different kind of energy. You know, it's like the spores of ferns floating in the stratosphere, you know, that just like happen to land on a piece of soil where the conditions just happen to be right. You know, there's enough water, there's enough nutrients in the ground. Some bird on its journey from Australia up to Alaska, you know, stops for a little while and, you know, leaves seeds or what have you, you know, to sort of start to grow. And these things grow and transform over eons, right, in these places. And there's a chain of islands that goes all the way up to Alaska. Most of them are submerged underwater. For the last almost 100 million years, this process of, you know, the fire coming, creating land masses, then being populated with life, and then being resubmerged into the ground, into the ocean. It's very important for our practice to know that there is a role for both of those energies. We can often feel like we want it to be sort of one or the other, you know, that the spiritual life, the Buddhist path it's all effortless. You know, it's just ease, it's just surrendering, it's just relaxing into what's happening. Or the other version that's like the warrior version, you know, the sort of like the intensity of drive that's needed to just, you know, penetrate into the now, you know, and just see everything with that kind of intensity, you know, that volcanic, fiery energy. And the truth is, it just depends. What's appropriate for right now depends. you know, what's skillful at this moment, it depends. Not getting fixated on saying, this is the right way to practice, this is the right way to respond to this experience. Having that flexibility is what keeps us going on our path. You know, and we can have these questions about it. You know, is liberation, you know, does it take a lifetime or does it happen in a moment? Are we solid or are we particles? Are we a self or is there no self? You know, there is often a tendency in our heart to want one or the other to be true, you know, to have an answer. And you know, it is like they say, sunlight, where it's most of the time, you know, under most conditions, it seems to operate as you know, waves and rays of light, wave energy. But then under certain ways of observing it, under certain conditions, it functions more in sort of discrete moments, right? Like packets of photons of energy. Even, you know, it's like there still is this sort of wanting. It's like, well, which is it, you know? And the same relationship with our own experience is called for, you know, of just, you know, that we tend to believe in the wholeness of things, right? The solidity of self, the oneness of things, all of these sort of notions and sometimes just, they're just, you know, the beliefs or views, and they're based on a certain experience of reality. They're not just made up, you know, they're based on how we've gone through life, you know. And separateness as real, you know, like if Greg threw his stick at me, you know, I'd end up with a bruise in the morning, not Greg, right? It's like we are separate, we're different. You know, there is a, it's part of reality. It's a version of it. It's a way of looking at it. And it happens to be the way that we tend to look at it. And so in this practice, we're going to offer a way of a method, a practice that is going to incline towards seeing things different than that, right? Towards the particular momentary experience of things, right? More in the sort of discrete mind moments, right? More in that way of things. Not to say that that's more real or that's a more true expression of what a being is or what life is about, but to give us perspective on the amazing capacity to not see things clearly. And that when we do see things clearly, we see that there's a huge range of how this experience can be seen, can be experienced, how the body and the mind can be known. And to actually get caught up or identified with any of them is suffering, is dukkha. It's not that one is, you know, more profound than another. It's just that it's profound to see the range, and it's a profound impact that that has on our notions of self, notions of body, notions of mind. A profoundly liberating impact. So it's very important to just be careful about dichotomies that might arise, you know, like, in a sense of preference or a sense of favoring or a sense of heightening one or the other, you know, an expansive kind of awareness or a very focused kind of awareness, a sort of general attention or specific. If something feels like it's on the surface or it feels deep, the mystical or the mundane, you know, it's like really being careful of thinking that one is more deep. None of it is more deep. You can have an experience of some far out experience of whatever, and it's like, it's no more profound than the totally normal, mundane experience of the body, of the mind. We think we can come on retreat looking for this kind of experience, and it's like, it doesn't matter. You could spend years just watching the rising and falling of the breath, it not doing anything that bizarre, and learn everything. Learn more than someone who might be going through all kinds of things and getting caught up in it, you know, feeling like, oh, this is the thing, this is what I'm here for. Because guaranteed, you watch your breath just rising and falling for 30 years and it's just boring. You're going to come up against all of the wanting of it to be different. The same wanting of something to happen, the same aversion to what's happening that any other experience is going to happen. Anything that can be experienced in the body or the mind, the six sense doors, it's all of the same nature. However we experience it with mindfulness, we experience it with kindness, that's the ticket, right, to deeper understanding. And so, you know, a big part of what we were doing here is like trying to stretch, you know, we're like, you know, stretching into difficult experience and trying to push our edges a little bit with just like, can we be willing to go through unpleasant experience a little more? Can we be willing to go through pleasant experience a little more and willingness to watch the heart contract and watch the wanting to arise, you know? There's a series of practices in the tradition called the Four Guardian Meditations, or the Four Protections, and they're the four practices are, the first is contemplating the virtues of the Buddha. The second is a contemplation of the body. The third is metta, contemplation of loving kindness. And the fourth is contemplation of death. And one of the really incredible things about the wisdom behind sort of putting these four things together is that you see that it does this expansion contraction thing, you know, that this notions of the virtues of the Buddha, you know, I mean, it's the ideas it's meant to inspire, you know, it's these kind of elevating, exciting, motivating qualities of the Buddha, you know, his worthiness, his self-realization, you know, there's a number of them, and some of the, you know, they can sort of tend to be a little more on the religious side of things. But the idea is, it's like, yeah, we're supposed to connect with not just the honoring of those virtues in the Buddha, but in ourselves, right? That we see that we all have the same fundamental capacities, you know, to be worthy, to realize these truths, you know, to destroy the taints and to realize the beauty of liberation. So there's this like uplifting quality. And then it's like, okay, contemplation of the body. Well, you know, okay. And it is in it tends to be a version of it that goes through, you know, a more identified, you know, head hair, body hair, nose hair, you know, pus, blood, spit, gunks of different kind, you know. And that's like rooting, you know, that is like, okay, we're back to earth from how great the Buddha was, you know. It's like, okay, the body, you know, and it's like, wow, disenchantment, liberatory disenchantment. It's not creating, and then you have, there's the tendency of like, oh, are we creating aversion to the body? Is there a way where we start to move into like unhealthy mind states or regarding that, you know? So then it's like, okay, metta practice, loving kindness. So the idea is to bring us back up, right? Bring us back into like the heart's capacity to care for ourselves, for one another. Expanded in the Brahma Viharas is, you know, the kindness toward pain in the world, the kindness toward joy. So that level of like, okay, the buoyancy that then comes back. And then the contemplation of death. The remembering of that inevitability, you know, for all of us. Holding both the love for ourselves and others and the understanding of what it means to exist in this world. That we stop existing at some point. So we go through these things, you know, over and over. Whether you're doing that practical kind, that sort of frame of practice around these four things, or just, you know, what we're doing is that, you know, it's like we're doing the loving kindness and we're doing the Vipassana. We're trying to balance both of those. You know, we're trying to create a heart that's open and kind and caring and buoyant enough to be able to handle the intensity of reality, you know, to be able to handle the truth of things, of their unpredictability and the hardness of just being in a body, you know, having a mind. The difficulty of that, it's like, oh, that gives us a chance when things seem hard of just remembering that we have this capacity to connect to kindness. And then, you know, like I've said before, of just then the wisdom part, purifying that kindness, purifying that caring, that ability to see what is, you know, pure, real caring about things, and then what is conditional caring, you know, caring if things end up a certain way, if things behave a certain way, then we love them, you know, if it'll last, we're willing to love it, versus if we know it's going to dissipate, then we protect our hearts from that, you know, so the wisdom path of really purifying the love so that it is able, truly able to love ourselves and all beings totally equally. Yeah, and then all the times where we don't need to stretch, you know, there's the value of kind of working at the edges, and there's the value of working in a place that feels more solid, you know, that feels more comfortable, that feels more safe. It's the point of the anchor, finding a place that's relatively neutral, you know, that we can come back to and explore, and really explore the experience of our relationship to more neutral phenomena. It's just really, I know I've already said it, but I just want to, again, it's like what we can learn out of boredom, out of disinterest, out of all of that world of things, it's just as important, it's just as valuable as seeing craving, as seeing aversion. It's the root of delusion. Not seeing clearly, not interested in seeing clearly. You know, so it's like everything is worthy of being known. Everything that you can experience in the body, in the mind, and all the sense doors is worthy of being known. It's worthy of having a relationship with. You could say that we are worthy of having a relationship with it all. And it's why we emphasize the concurrence, you know, that trying to keep the continuity of mindfulness throughout the day. Sure, there's the sitting periods and there's the walking periods, but really all those in-between periods, all the interstitial moments are so fundamental, right? To be able to see, and it often will be where we see things powerfully because we do relax a little bit sometimes. And it's like, can we relax enough that we're not so tight on experience, but also keep the determined energy of mindfulness going? It's a delicate balance, but it can often be in those times. Saito Lakana, who's the abbot of the monastery in Chazwa, he said once, every time food touches your tongue, try to attain wisdom. And it's like, wow. Such a beautiful invitation. And really getting it. Yeah, every moment it's there. There's nothing that we do that's too mundane for insight. He said, don't just let it pass by. Try to make it beneficial. In the name of that, food, meditation. I found this in one of my new favorite cookbooks. It's Marcella Hazan, her Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking. Okay. Have the sauce ready when the pasta is done. Do not let drained pasta sit in the colander waiting for the sauce to be finished. Okay, transfer cooked, drained pasta without a moment's delay to a warm serving bowl. The instant it's in the bowl, start tossing it with the sauce. In the sequence of steps that lead to producing a dish of pasta and getting it to the table, none is more important than tossing. Up to the time you toss, pasta and sauce are two separate entities. Tossing bridges the separation and makes them one. The sauce must coat every strand thoroughly and evenly, reach into every crevice, and with it carry the flavors of the components of the sauce. However marvelous the sauce may be, it cannot merely sit on top of or at the bottom of the bowl. If it is not broadly and uniformly distributed, the pasta for which it is intended will have a little flavor. That is awesome meditation, for mindfulness instructions, you know? And she goes on to talk about how, this, you know, it's like the sauce actually, you know, it penetrates into the pasta, you know, and there's this, like, unity of flavor and experience that comes out of that, you know? And it's just, it's so true. And sometimes it could be helpful to have a little bit of lightness, right, with what we're doing here, of just like the capacity for the object and subject to come together, right? For there to actually not be a distinction, for that unity of experience, not in a way that's just controlled, but in a way that is natural, that understands the natural relationship of things like that. It's a wonderful way to practice. You can just sit there and toss the pasta and the sauce in every moment. And when we do that, you know, when we try to do that, we have a chance at seeing the world as it is, seeing our lives as they are, and not just as we imagine they are, or imagine they should be, or imagine how we want them. I'm going to pick on those acupuncturists again that I talked about in the last talk, the ones at the monastery in Burma who were committed to finding sleeping at the monastery instead of the hotel that was offered them because there wasn't room. And if folks weren't, anyone here wasn't, you know, there were wonderful acupuncturists who are offering wonderful treatment and training to a lot of folks. And then this other group who came, and it was a really different sort of thing. It really was designed as like an experience that they paid for, didn't pay us, paid someone else for, to come and teach acupuncture and stay at this monastery. Anyhow, so amidst the kerfuffle of me trying to explain how there wasn't room at the monastery for them, there was one woman who just, she was so upset and so angry with me and in general. And she just said, if I can't stay here, I'm going to go trekking. And I just said, I was like, well, aren't you here to help people? Because... You know, I mean, people come from hundreds of miles away. They're totally impoverished. They have had lives of unbearably difficult work that their bodies are trying to recover from, right? And they're there to help these people, you know? And so I was like, aren't you here to help people? And she said, I don't want to hear about it. Oh, and it was so sad, you know? It was so hard and so sad to see that degree of frustration with what was happening, you know, and then how totally lost someone can get. We all can get in that fixation and totally lose track of our own motivation, of the most wholesome and sacred motivation that might actually be impelling our actions from the deepest place. But we can really just lose sight of that so much, you know. Think about how much we can even just lose sight of that on retreat, you know, when it's ourselves that we're trying to treat, that we're trying to help, you know. And the difference between that and, you know, right around the same time, there was a yogi who I saw in an interview, and had the interview, and the interview was basically over. And then she said, "You know, it's the one. There's one other thing that happened, which is I was at lunch, and I was reaching for the food, and I just saw so clearly that it really mattered if I reached with greed." And you could see, like, you know, tears start to kind of well up, and just the profundity of that, of just that very simple and absolutely profound insight into the motivation of our actions and the impact that they have. It was really powerful and beautiful for me to see that range, you know, and to see what are the worlds that we create being one way or another. You know, and that we're always going to have parts, you know, we're going to continue to find parts of ourselves for a long time that are more caught up in how we think things should be and want things to be and not be interested. We don't want to hear it. We don't want to hear about how we should feel about this or how we should be operating, you know. But that you all have had enough experience here, even just this week, never mind in your lives outside and the previous retreats you've done, of just seeing the possibility of purifying that relationship between intention and action, between seeing what is motivating our actions in the world, what kind of world that might create. So there's times, you know, where we may have doubt. We may have a moment of doubt. And really think about the nature of what that talking to can be. You know, it's like, it's not about beating yourself up about having doubt, but that there can be times where it's really helpful to remind yourselves about the deepest and most beautiful motivations that have brought you here. And trust that they are beautiful, they are wholesome, they are such good qualities that have already brought you here, that you've already had, that intention has already created this action, you know, and that the continued pursuit of it is the most beautiful thing that we can do with our lives. And that it, you know, when it's hard to just see that it might be worth it. It might be worth going through what we go through. If it means that we can care that much, you know, understand that much. Let's sit for a moment. We have half an hour of walking before